Good day, and welcome to the Faker Drinker Inside the Beltway conference call. And at this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Fred Riche. Please go ahead, sir.
Well, thank you very much. Hello, everybody. This is Fred Riche. I'm a partner with Faker Drinker, and I'm in the Los Angeles office. With me, importantly, are two other people. There's Jim Dolan is with me, and Jim will speak to us in a minute. Jim's the Vice President of Retirement Strategies at NetTixis Investment Managers, and Jim supports this program. NetTixis supports this program, for which we're very grateful. Also with me is my partner from our Washington, D.C. office, Brad Campbell, who, because we're going to talk a lot about Department of Labor stuff, is an especially good voice for this program because we're going to talk about a lot of DOL guidance. And Brad was previously the Assistant Secretary at the Employee Benefit Security Administration, meaning it was the group that he oversaw that's issuing this guidance. So we're going to have a sensational program for you today. There's a lot to talk about. By the way, if you have compatriots at work or others who might be interested in this program, as we said a minute ago, it'll be recorded. It takes a few days, maybe a week, to get it put together and posted. We'll send an email out to everybody who registered for the program with a link in it so that you can refer it on to other people or listen to it again if you want. So remember, that'll be about a week. It'll be on, if you want to look at it, if you don't get the email, it'll be at fakerdrinker.com, our website, obviously, under the tab Inserts and Events, and give it about a week before you look for it. But you should get that email, so you shouldn't need to look for it. Having said that, Jim, once again, I want to thank you so much for your support and just give you a chance to say a little something. So, Jim Dolan.
Thanks so much, Brett. Certainly appreciate the time, and we're grateful for the partnership. I want to thank Faker Drinker for providing this hour, and I want to thank everyone for calling in today to get some information around the recent DOL proposal. For those of you who aren't familiar with NetTixis, we believe in active management. We have 20 investment managers globally, and our focus is to provide and help you address the unique needs and challenges that exist in the marketplace. For me in my role, leading our strategic accounts for our U.S. retirement business, one of the needs of the marketplace for us is focusing on sustainable investing. And for those of you who don't know, NetTixis is the only firm that provides a sustainable target date series. So we're really excited to be able to have Fred and Brad talk a bit today and kind of clarify, I think, all the questions that we may have in regards to ESG in 401k plans. So with that, Fred, I'll turn it back to you. Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you, Jim, and thanks to NetTixis. And let's jump right into the deep end of the pool here. Brad, I want you to tell everybody about the two pieces of guidance that the DOL issued on the fiduciary advice definition and on a proposed exemption. And you know, lay it out a little bit, what they're doing and why you think they're doing it. So, Brad, over to you.
All right. Well, as Fred said, although I personally wouldn't have claimed in advance this is going to be a sensational program, that's a lot of pressure to put on a discussion of a bunch of ERISA stuff. But nonetheless, there is a tremendous amount going on. So, what we're starting off with then is Fiduciary Rule 3.0, because if you really follow this, it goes back to 2010 when DOL put out the first iteration of this. So just to review the bidding, as you all well remember, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals struck down, vacated the previous DOL fiduciary rule, and so we reverted back to the 1975 regulation with its five-part test. And the Department of Labor back in 2018, when that happened, said, here is a temporary enforcement policy, which you can follow in the meantime. And that temporary enforcement policy basically says if you abide by the impartial conduct standards, then DOL and IRS won't go after you for a prohibited transaction. But they said, and we'll come back and do something next to make everything more permanent. And so finally now here on July 7th, DOL did come back with a new proposed class exemption and some new guidance. And they did some really quite surprising things in that. And let's take the two separately because I think it's important to understand the differences in what's happening. The regulatory part of the quote-unquote fiduciary rule is a new proposed class exemption, which would would make okay under the prohibited transaction rules the receipt of commissions or variable compensation, sort of any reasonable compensation really, related to fiduciary investment advice, and also make permissible certain principal transactions. So this proposed class exemption is a regulatory undertaking. It is a notice and comment process, and the comment period is only 30 days. It ends next Thursday on August 6th. So folks are in the midst of reviewing that class exemption and making comments on it. What DOL did with this class exemption is model it very closely on the requirements of the SEC's new regulation best interest. And so their goal was to put out a class exemption that would be of significant utility across a variety of investment advice purposes, and that would harmonize the ERISA standards with the SEC standards. And by and large, they've done that. I think we're going to see a number of comments with technical improvements and so forth, but by and large, I think the reception of the class exemption has been pretty positive, that it would be useful to have a broad-based class exemption. It does not create new causes of action. It mirrors the requirements of regulation best interest, such that if you're complying with Reg BI, complying with this new exemption will be relatively simple. So you add all that together, and I think you're going to see a lot of comments expressing support for the approach and then, you know, tweaking a little bit some of the details. The other half of the fiduciary rule, so to speak.
Brad, let me jump in before you leave that. Just some interesting comments about it. I think the primary beneficiary, my suspicion first is that this will become final around the first of the year because it seems like they're really pushing it hard, the DOL is and the administration. So I'm thinking maybe January 1-ish. Assuming that's the case, will be in effect for next year. Primary beneficiary of it, from my view, will be the broker-dealer community because they can receive 12b1 fees, commissions, front-end loads on mutual funds, trailing fees on variable annuities, and so on. And if you know, for those of you listening in, keep in mind as I make those comments, this is an exemption for non-discretionary fiduciary investment advice to plans, to participants, and to IRAs. And I'd like to come back to IRAs later and talk about what some of the impact there might be. But for the moment, I just wanted to clarify that it's only a proposal right now, but I think it's going to come into effect pretty much the way it is. And it's plans, participants, and IRAs. So don't just think in terms of investment advice to plans. So I just wanted to interject that, Brad. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's a very good point. It can be used for rollovers. It can be used in a fairly wide array of advice situations. But as you say, it's about non-discretionary advice. This is for fiduciary investment advice, not fiduciary exercise of discretion, not for exercising discretion over assets. So that's the first part. And I agree with you, Fred. I think they are going to be moving that pretty quickly. I think we'll see the final exemption granted probably no later than October sometime, and it'll have been valid and gone into effect by January. So I agree with you. This is something that the Trump administration, I think, is going to get out the door and get finalized in fairly short order. The other part in the fiduciary rule was really rather surprising. It's not a regulatory action. It's basically new guidance reinterpreting the 1975's Regulation 5-part test that is described in a couple of pages in the Federal Register in the preamble to the proposed exemption. So just to make that clear, the new fiduciary guidance is not a regulatory proposal on which they're taking notice and comment. It's basically an immediate statement of what the department thinks fiduciary investment advice means. So what they've done is they've rescinded Advisory Opinion 2005-23, which is an opinion that said in most cases rollover recommendations would not be ERISA fiduciary advice. And one of the primary reasons is under the five-part test. One of the tests is that you have to regularly provide fiduciary advice in order to be an ERISA fiduciary. The test, just so we're all on the same page, is the advice individualized, provided on a regular basis for a fee, subject to a mutual understanding that the advice will be a primary basis for the decision-making. What DOL's done in this guidance is reverse its opinion about what those words mean. Whereas for quite a long time, we've had and embodied finally in that 2005 opinion one set of interpretation of what a regular basis means, DOL has now said, we've changed our minds. We think regular basis means something different. And as a result, many more rollover transactions are now going to be subject to the ERISA fiduciary standard. What did they change in particularly the regular basis prong? Well, what they've said is, we were wrong in 2005. What we now think regular basis means is that the recommendation for the rollover, even though that's a discrete one-time bit of advice, could be part of either an ongoing relationship or an anticipated ongoing relationship. If it's an ongoing relationship, they give the example of you're getting recommendations about securities and other investments from an advisor, and after you've been dealing with them for a while, they then give you a recommendation about a rollover. Even though that other advice didn't involve ERISA, it was part of an ongoing relationship, and therefore, because they eventually gave you ERISA advice, it meets the regular basis prong. That's one of their interpretations. The other, which I think is even more frankly surprising, is the anticipated ongoing basis. The notion there is, even if I'm sitting down with my advisor for the first time, I'm a new client, we have never done business before, if in that first meeting he or she recommends a rollover, and both of us anticipate that he or she is going to be giving me regular advice after the rollover, then it meets the regular basis prong because we probably will be providing multiple rounds of advice in the future. So we anticipate an ongoing relationship, therefore there is presently a regular basis. Now, as you can probably hear from my voice, I personally think this is a very unnatural, bad reading of the rule, and I personally think this guidance is misguided. But that is their current position and what they've stated in the preamble to this class exemption.
Brad, let me ask you a question about that. It seems to me that language in the preamble to the exemption really is just saying, the DOL is just saying, here's how we currently interpret the fiduciary advice rule. Therefore, this applies today. Do you agree, or do you think they're just warning people that next year we're going to start interpreting it that way?
No, I agree. That is how it's written. We rescind the advisory opinion. Here is what we think rollover advice means. Here are what we think the words regular basis now mean. So I agree with you. I think it is operative at this moment in terms of it being DOL's position. I do think it's worth mentioning, though, that this is sub-regulatory guidance. It's not a regulation. They have not proposed changing a single word of the 1975 rule. They've simply changed their minds in what's nearly a 180 on what they think the rule means. I personally think that raises a lot of concerns. This is a substantive change that would, if it has the force of law, really substantially affect how many rollover transactions are now ERISA fiduciary transactions as well. I don't personally view this as a topic that's appropriate for sub-regulatory guidance. I think this is the kind of thing that the Trump administration would normally criticize as regulating in a guidance document, which is a topic on which they've issued an executive order. So as you can see, I'm very concerned about this particular part of the fiduciary rule, and I think it's an unusual circumstance that the department's done it this way. And I think we'll need to look closely to see, are they going to issue additional guidance that clarifies or otherwise addresses some of the issues that are brought up in this first round of guidance. It may be the only round, we don't know, but this is definitely an area worth watching because, at least from DOL's opinion, this is a substantive change in how they think the fiduciary definition applies.
Yeah, let me throw in a couple of random comments here. First is to put an exclamation on the end of one of Brad's sentences, which is, what advisor doesn't recommend, or what advisor ever recommends that a participant roll over their money with somebody other than that advisor? That's just not natural. So almost every rollover recommendation would contemplate that the advisor would have an ongoing relationship on investments with the participant in the plan. Therefore, almost every recommendation would satisfy the regular basis test, if the DOL goes ahead with this interpretation, which they seem determined to do. The only example
let me interrupt just one thought there, because I do want to be fair to DOL. They did, consistent with what the Fifth Circuit said, they did note that a pure one-time sales transaction, say the recommendation of an insurance policy where no future advice would be given, would not be ERISA fiduciary. So they did acknowledge that there could be rollovers that are not fiduciary in nature. But it's also important to notice that they were very unclear as to exactly what types of recommendations, advice, services on an ongoing basis might be fiduciary and which might not. So it calls into question the notion of, if I have an ongoing relationship, but it's a sales relationship, is it now converted to a fiduciary one? But I'm sorry to interrupt, Fred. I just wanted to get that in there because I didn't want to overstate DOL's position.
Yeah, that's sort of where I was going to, Brad, by saying almost every recommendation. As Brad said, the example they gave was the sale of an annuity, where it was a one-time sale and the advisor had no ongoing relationship with the participant or retiree. Even there, you can sort of start distinguishing in your mind between different types of annuities. That would be probably fairly common for a fixed rate annuity. But for a variable annuity or a fixed indexed annuity, would there be contemplated ongoing services? For example, helping with the methodology, the mutual funds or the indexes as time goes by and the participant or the individual ages. So the DOL literally said it is a facts and circumstances test, which means some cases will be pretty clear one way or the other way, but there's also going to be cases that fall in the gray area. We're just going to have to live with that one for a while. Brad, to me, one of the most interesting things, there are a whole series of disclosures and conditions in the proposed exemption. Two of them I found particularly interesting. One was that the entity, the supervisor entity, for example, a broker-dealer, and the advisor had to acknowledge that they were fiduciaries, even though it didn't create a right of action. And the other was that every year, at least, the entity has to do a retrospective review of their policies and procedures and their compliance efforts, and implicit is, and determine that they're working or make changes. And the CEO of the broker-dealer, or the entity more generally, has to sign off on that. That struck me as not typical DOL thinking. Any thoughts on where that came from, that retrospective review and the CEO sign-off?
Yeah, I think a number of things here. Because DOL was modeling this exemption on regulation best interest, it does depart from what we've seen as sort of the traditional class exemption conditions. And I think you're going to see a lot of comments coming in between now and next Thursday on both of those points, in particular on the point where the financial institution and the investment professional have to acknowledge in writing that they're fiduciaries. Well, as we just discussed, under DOL's new guidance, it's not necessarily clear at the outset whether I'm a fiduciary. And I think what DOL would probably hopefully agree is that we would want this class exemption to be available fairly broadly. So I think you're going to see a lot of comments saying, hey, you should withdraw that requirement for a couple of reasons. One, we don't know for sure if we're a fiduciary in some cases. Two, even if the investment professional is a fiduciary to the participant, it's not at all clear that in all cases the institution will be a fiduciary the same way the professional is. So having both of them acknowledge that status is problematic. And third, in any event, they're all going to be following the impartial conduct standards, which include the best interest recommendation. So, you know, what is the additional utility you get from demanding this fiduciary status, given that they're all already going to be providing the best interest recommendations? So for all those reasons, I think you're going to see a lot of comments saying to DOL, you know, you want this to be used, and that particular condition is going to make it more difficult to use the exemption. As far as the CEO sign-off, I think you're going to see a lot of comments saying this should really be a job of the chief compliance officer or a similar entity, given that the purpose is to make sure this exemption is working and to change it as it goes forward. That's probably more of a compliance officer function than an executive function.
One last thought, and then we can move on to the next subject. But I said earlier, I think this is going to impact IRAs, or it could, more than people realize, because my experience is that it's very common for broker-dealers and their representatives to provide ongoing advice to owners of IRAs. And the IRS has never enforced the prohibited transaction rules there, although there is in the code a provision virtually identical to the ERISA provision. And if this focuses more attention on that, I think that the broker-dealers, investment advisors, and others will want to say, hey, we're complying with the exemption. And if they comply with the exemption, then they're going to have to satisfy all the conditions in the exemption that Brad and I have been talking about. So I think it could add a little tension to investment advice to IRAs, but maybe not as bad as it might have a year or two ago, because we now have Reg BI, and to a degree, this exemption is modeled on Reg BI.
I would just echo that by saying, because this is an alternative exemption, you could still use other exemptions that are out there. This is more flexible than the last time we got involved with DOL here. Also, there's no mandatory contract. There's no mandatory class action lawsuits as a result of those contracts. So some of the concerns that we had with the best interest contract exemption, that this is sort of, this fills a similar role, but it does it without a lot of those other baggage that caused so many concerns.
Yeah, I think absolutely. It's going to be easier to comply with, and the rules seem more not only practical, but they hit the highly relevant issues. Anyway, let's move on to the next subject. Brad, talk to us about the guidance, the proposed guidance from the DOL on environmental, social, and governance factors, ESG.
Yeah, so this is sort of a surprise rulemaking, one of two that DOL is giving us here in the near future. And by that I mean the fall regulatory agenda came out November 20th of last year, and it is supposed to include anything the agency is looking to do as a regulation in the next 12 months. That did not have this proposed regulation on ESG factors listed, and yet that was proposed, and the comment period on it closes today. So this is a new regulation that DOL has come up with. And the real distinction I think people need to be aware of here is this isn't a new issue. DOL has been issuing guidance on how fiduciaries should consider and not consider ESG factors since 1994. There was guidance in 94. In 2008, we put out additional guidance, and full disclosure, I was the person who put out the 2008 guidance. Then the Obama administration put out 2015 guidance, and then the Trump administration put out 2018 guidance. And now they're culminating in saying, enough guidance, it's time for a regulation. So this is a proposed regulation that talks about how fiduciaries should consider ESG and other factors. And the first thing I think we ought to do is dispel some of the misconceptions. This is not a prohibition on ESG investing by ERISA plans. What this is saying there's lots of different kinds of ESG. In an ERISA plan, you have an obligation to consider what DOL is now calling the pecuniary factors of an investment. In other words, the obligation as a fiduciary is to invest for the economic benefit of your participants, not to achieve collateral goals. So you can take into account pecuniary factors, i.e. factors that affect the investment and their return and the risk that's being taken, and all of the other, those types of, you know, economic factors that go into analyzing an investment. within that context, ESG functions quite well in ERISA. There are a host of investment products that include ESG factors in a pecuniary fashion. And DOL in this proposed regulation would agree with that. So it's not a prohibition on ESG. It's a focus on the fact that an ERISA plan can't select an investment that elevates ESG goals more than it elevates participant returns. So within that context, basically it's in some ways a roadmap for how fiduciaries should consider ESG investing. That said, it does include some provisions that you're going to see a lot of comments on, because one of the things it concluded was that ESG factors could not be present in a QDIA. So while an ESG could be a core menu investment, an ESG-themed investment could be a core menu item, it couldn't be a QDIA. And the way they've structured the proposal, there's actually no definition of what ESG means. So personally, and Fred, you and I have talked about this quite a bit, I think the way they've written it could theoretically mean that any investment, whether it's intended to be ESG or not, that looked at, say, a dysfunctional corporate governance situation and used that to evaluate the investment, could potentially fall under this prohibition on being a QDIA. I don't think that's what DOL intended, but I think there's some issues with how it's drafted. That comment period closes today, and you're going to see a lot of comments coming into DOL saying, you know, this regulation needs some more work.
Yeah, Brad, I agree. I mean, in some ways, it's nonsensical. What if an investment manager were looking at investments to select for a mutual fund or a collective investment trust, and they felt that pollution was going to become more heavily regulated in the future and was going to be disfavored, arguably this regulation almost says you can't take that into account, or that a company, if a company had a diverse board of directors, that it reflected that the company understood that diversity was being more prized in America, that the company needed to be able to reach out to Latin American heritage consumers, needed to reach out to Black consumers, needed to understand the cultural differences between different races and religions and values, and that couldn't be taken into account. I mean, you reach the level that it's almost nonsense. The Harvard commented to the DOL, the rule should be turned upside down. Planned fiduciaries should be required to consider all factors which affect risk and return or justify where they do not, rather than the other way around. And I think there are a couple things happening here. One is, I think the DOL thinking is outdated. I think they're still of the school of thought that ESG investing means, oh no, we're going to favor, companies that the millennials like because they're green companies, and we're not considering that as factors. We're considering that just to try to sell our mutual fund or to have some impact, as opposed to, no, many investment advisors consider these factors because they think it's going to affect either the risk or the return or a combination of the two. And they sort of mushed all that together and said, we don't like it. We think it's a problem. On the other hand, you're right. It does say, hey, here's how you need to do it. Here's a process for doing it. So I just think there's some outdated thinking there that underlies the regulation. And I agree with you. I think there are going to be a lot of comments that object to it. And try to explain to the Department of Labor why they're off base in doing this, and urge them to gather more information so that they really understand the marketplace. The thing that I find absolutely fascinating on it is we have a Republican administration telling investment advisors what they can and cannot consider and how they should consider it, which seems so much the opposite of what political conservatism would say, which is ordinarily, we think the private sector is better at doing this than the government is. Here they're trying to substitute the government's judgment for the private sector's. It just makes no sense to me at all in that way either. So anyway, okay, Brad, I've vented. You want to close this subject? One last comment.
Well, you've almost inspired me to vent as well. I think both the ESG rule and the new guidance on how to interpret the fiduciary advice regulation, frankly, both of these are sort of surprising policy positions to take. Not the ESG isn't surprising in the sense that all the way back to the Clinton administration, every administration, Republican or Democrat, has said, hey, the job of retirement investing is to invest for the economic outcome of the participants. This isn't a place, you know, we're not going to let you invest in something just because it feels good if it's not going to make money. That's not a position that's particularly radical or difficult, and that really is the thrust, historically, of what the CSG has been about. What is unusual is what you said, which is to single out ESG factors as being sort of different than other factors, and in this one area to have the Labor Department dictate how you consider them, rather than relying on generally accepted investment theories by investment professionals. Now, to be fair, again, the proposal allows ESG when it's considered in that way. So it's not a prohibition, except in the sense of the QDIA part. So, you know, there's mixed messages there. On the one hand, there's a caution the department seems to have about ESG being misused. On the other hand, their solution is a little more authoritarian than is the norm for how ERISA treats investment decisions. So anyway, I'll get off my soapbox other than to say it's been a very interesting month looking at what's coming out of the Labor Department on policy.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, we've vented there. Let's move on. Talk to me, Brad, about the DOL issued some guidance on allocations to private equity by investment managers who have who are using it as an asset allocation rather than a standalone investment. Bring us up to speed on that.
Yeah, so it's interesting. The policy behind this is sort of the opposite of the policy behind the ESG proposal. The policy on this is generally accepted investment theories have demonstrated in elsewhere in investing, but especially in defined benefit plans, have demonstrated that these types of investments are widely adopted, have significant value for plans, and should be part of defined contribution plans as well. And so the guidance that the DOL has put out basically says you can have allocations to these investments as part of otherwise diversified investments. And if the allocations aren't, you know, overwhelmingly large, it's a valid and useful part of, you know, an overall diversified portfolio. So, you know, again, it really is kind of striking. It is the opposite of the ESG approach. It's the government saying, hey, the time has come for us to acknowledge that change in the marketplace suggests that these things are appropriate, whereas on the ESG part, they're sort of saying, eh, well, we're not sure we like this. We're going to, you know, put some brakes on it. So try and find the commonality is difficult. But I think in terms of the policy here, it is the right one. It's saying that where fiduciaries see the advantages of using these, where they're offering different types of investments where there are uncorrelated risks, where there are reasons that this sector makes a lot of sense, they should be free to use those. That's not to say that you can just have a, you know, new investment on the plan menu that's all these things. It's saying these can be part of otherwise diversified options. So in that sense, I think it's been welcome news to most folks in the investment community, and is something that'll probably be, you know, fairly quickly adopted.
Yeah, my sense is that I read the guidance, and my initial reaction was, well, shoot, this is consistent with, investment theories by investment managers of defined benefit plans and other large investment pools. So it struck me more as the DOL reassuring people that it was permissible, rather
right.
than breaking any new ground. I mean, to me, it was just, this is what the law is and has been for many, many years. It's just applied in this particular scenario. Was that the vibe you got out of it too, Brad?
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right that is the case. I think the significance of them saying it is that it removes any sort of barriers and doubts that fiduciaries might have had. Because I think in general, ERISA fiduciaries are a somewhat cautious bunch, and when investments that aren't traditionally included in their type of plan are being offered to them, I think they start out by saying, are we sure this is okay? So the value of this is DOL saying, yeah, this is okay. It's been going on for a while. But I would tend to agree with you, Fred. It wasn't so much that they were breaking new ground as just acknowledging the direction that investment professionals have been going.
Yeah, I think so too. Okay, well, we're going to give you all a break from all of the excitement about the Department of Labor, and we're going to go to a more boring agency. We're going to and appropriately so. We're going to go over to the IRS for a little while, and we're going to talk about three pieces of guidance issued by the IRS related to the CARES Act. We don't have time to really go into detail, so we'll just highlight them. But there are three IRS notices that were helpful. There was IRS Notice 2020-50, 50-51, and 52. Brad, let me just highlight one or two things about each one, and then you can jump in with any additional thoughts. 2020-50 dealt with what I call CRDs. Many people call CRDs. That's coronavirus-related distributions. If you remember, those were a participant could take a distribution up to $100,000, but obviously not in excess of their vested account balance. If they are a qualified individual, and a qualified individual is fairly narrowly construed in the statute. Basically, if the participant, the spouse, or a dependent tested positively for COVID-19, then yes, they would qualify. And then they went on to have some other financially adverse consequences to the participant. It also authorized the Secretary of Treasury to expand the definition under adverse financial consequences. And what 2020-50 did was they included the spouse and any member of the household was laid off or furloughed or couldn't get child care or had a job offer rescinded. It greatly expanded who could be a qualified individual. It still had to be based on the impact of COVID-19, but it now allows impact on the spouse and any dependent in the household as well as impact on the participant. By the way, if you took that $100,000 or less of CRD, it's taxed 130 year over 3 years, but if you pay it back anywhere in the 3 year period, all or part of it, you can recoup the taxes on the part that you're paid back. Very flexible. I actually think a good idea. That definition of qualified individual also applies for coronavirus related loans. And those are loans of, expanding the regular loan limits up to $100,000 or your vested account balance, but 100% of your vested account balance. And as Brad has pointed out to me, that at first blush, that looks like a nice thing, that $100,000, the monthly repayment would be about $1,600 or $1,700 a month, which is tough for a lot of people to be able to, even if they're back at work, to be able to make those payments. And then the last thing that if you're a qualified individual, you could do is the company could suspend the requirements for repayments for 1 year. For example, your March 31 payment. These have to be payments due after March 27th, the date of the act. But for the March 31, 2020 payment could be extended to March 31, 2021. Same for June 30, September 30, December 31, 1 year out. And then the loan reamortizes. So very helpful for people who are impacted by it. The data I've seen says that large plans, significant numbers of them are adopting those provisions, smaller plans, not so much. Moving on to 2020-51, that related to required minimum distributions. The way the original guidance was drafted, that if you received an RMD, if a person received an RMD from a plan or an IRA, and they were, in this case, you don't have to be a qualified individual. That only applied to the first piece of guidance I was talking about. For required minimum distributions, if you received a distribution between February 1 and July 15th, you had the longer of July 15th or 60 days to roll it back over again because there's a holiday on R&Ds because valuations of the market at the time the act was passed were much lower than they were on December 31. And from a congressional perspective, it didn't make sense to force people to take distributions and liquidate their investments in that period. The subsequent guidance said, hey, wait a second. We're going to extend that back to any distribution received after January 1, not February 1, and we're going to extend it out to the later of 60 days or August 31. So if you have clients who took an RMD out of their IRAs or out of a plan, and they can still roll it back over until August 31, but obviously now's the time to talk to them. The last piece of guidance, Notice 2020-52, I'm just going to very quickly say it creates more flexibility for suspending contributions to safe harbor plans, safe harbor 401k plans. There's no way to describe that without getting way down in the weeds, so my advice to you is if you have a client with a safe harbor plan and they're in financial trouble, talk to your third-party administrator, talk to your record keeper. They're up to speed on this. They can help figure out what the issues and circumstances are. You, the client, and that service provider can have some opportunities now that are more flexible than they were before. Brad, do you want to add to that, or should we go on to the next one?
Just very briefly, I would say the self-certification issue, what surprised me over the last couple of months is I've gotten more questions from plan sponsor clients who are saying, I believe my employees are lying about their eligibility for the coronavirus distributions. What should I do? Should I deny it? First of all, the IRS guidance says you can rely on their self-certification unless you know it to be false. What we've been telling plan sponsors is why would you want to put yourself in as the gatekeeper for the IRS? Use a process where the person certifies that they meet one or more of the following criteria without identifying them specifically. So there's no way to know for sure whether they're lying. That issue became even more clear once the IRS guidance came out because it now includes things like if your spouse lost his or her side job, let's say they were driving Uber on the weekends. That would technically qualify as a loss that would make your whole, you, the participant, eligible. And there's really no reasonable way the employer would know any of that and be able to say that you know that it was false. So, you know, it's just been interesting to me how many employers have really wanted to interject themselves into that process when really the IRS gives you a safe harbor for staying out of it by just having them self-certify without a particular reason identified.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think people are overthinking the issue. If somebody says, well, where's our risk? I mean, the risk is not in suspecting something or believing something. You have to have actual knowledge that somebody is lying before you can't grant the distribution of the loan. And as Brad explained, how do you do that with this very, very broad definition of what qualifies? I tell people, well, if you're going to worry about anything, worry about a plan committee member saying that we're, you know, the committee is the decision maker, or an officer of the company's title starts with a C, CEO, CFO. If one of them applied, you may know because they're in constant conversations or they have the responsibility for administering it. But I'm even making that up. I think without actual knowledge, then the committee is obligated to, or not obligated. If there is this plan provision, the committee doesn't have to take any steps to investigate. That is very, very clear. Okay.
And let's also remember, no plan has to adopt these provisions. It's elective for the plan to decide whether they want to do it or not.
Exactly. One of the great
oddities. Meaning offer CRDs at all.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. None of these have to be offered. One of the great oddities, though, is that even if the plan treats a distribution as a required minimum distribution, the participant doesn't have to. So the plan doesn't get to decide whether or not the participant is a coronavirus-related, or whether or not the participant can roll it over. The participant can roll it over, period. That's the participant's election. So anyway, okay, we've beaten that one. Brad, let's turn to another biggie. The next topic we're going to talk about are pooled employer plans, so-called PEPs, which personally I believe have great potential to expand the coverage in the marketplace and maybe even to become a replacement for any many individual plans. They become effective January 1, but one of the issues is that in many of the models, the business models used to design these PEPs, there can be prohibited transactions. For example, proprietary investments, the PEPs plan provider, the PPP, setting their own compensation, hiring affiliates to be the record keeper or the TPA or the trustee or the investment manager, and so on. So along came a request for information, an RFI from the Department of Labor. And with that, Brad, take it away.
Yeah, so as Fred said, pooled employer plans can go live on January 1, but there's still a lot of what we're effectively dealing with at this point is the statute itself. Beyond that, we don't have a lot of guidance from DOL or IRS, which is, you know, I'm not criticizing them for that. It's been a relatively busy last 6 months for all of those agencies, so it's not surprising. In fact, they have done quite a lot. As Fred said, DOL put out a request for information where it started asking questions about things like, do we need exemptions, and if so, what should they cover? It's worth pointing out that that engendered a pretty feisty response from Capitol Hill. Chairman Neal of the Ways and Means Committee explained to DOL in a letter that he sent that his view was if they'd intended there to be exemptions, they would have written them into the law, and he doesn't want to see DOL doing that using its own independent authority. We'll have to wait and see how that plays out. The RFI, I think, has just recently concluded. But interestingly enough, the DOL sent a regulation, a proposed regulation, over to the White House for review on July 15th. So there is a proposed rule coming to implement pooled employer plans under the SECURE Act. And what I just read you is about all we know about it. My suspicion is that this won't include exemptions simply because it's described as a rule, and normally exemptions are described as exemptions. But DOL is clearly moving on the pooled employer plan and getting ready to publish a proposed regulation in the not too distant future. What we've typically seen is when DOL sends a rule over in the ERISA space, it doesn't languish the full 90 days that the normal process allows. Typically, within a month, those rules get published. So we could, in the next couple of weeks, see an actual pooled employer plan regulation proposed by DOL. That said, Fred, I'll just say this. Pooled employer plans seem to have a lot of interest. I hear a lot of conflicting views about how well they'll work. But there's definitely a lot of interest in moving them out there. And I think this is a real significant potential change in the marketplace, and it is something everyone should be paying attention to. But that doesn't necessarily mean it'll be a success. That'll depend on how things actually play out in the market and what people want. But it is one of the more significant changes in terms of options available to plans that we've seen in some time.
Yeah, from the perspective of advisors, my recommendation is that you learn about the different business models. Because one thing that I've learned through this, and Brad, I suspect you've seen the same thing, there are a lot of different models being brought to market. And by models, I mean, you could have like a conflict-free model where maybe a third party, nothing is free, but of conflicts, but where maybe a third-party administrator brings it to market with everything, all the other services, all the investments being non-proprietary and no revenue sharing being collected by the TPA, just pure fee for service. Or you could see a completely bundled package where everything is proprietary, all the services, all the investments, or many of the investments. So and then everything in between those two. Those are sort of the two ends of the spectrum. I think the first job of advisors before they can recommend these is to understand them well enough so that they know which ones to recommend to which of their clients, assuming they are going to be recommending them. So I don't know, Brad, is that your experience as well?
Yeah, I think advisors need to pay attention to this because these pooled employer plans will either be an opportunity, a risk, or irrelevant. And one way to look at what I just said is that's an obvious tautology. Of course, it's going to be one of those three outcomes. But my point in saying it is, for some advisors, this could actually eat into their business as smaller plans get aggregated. For others, it'll be completely irrelevant because their plans really aren't the kind suited towards a common structure. They need a highly individualized plan that does sort of specialized things. And for others, it may just be that this doesn't pan out to be, the sea change that some think it will. You know, I really have to say this has been interesting to me talking to different folks in the marketplace, those who are starting PEPs, those enthusiastically, those who are starting PEPs grudgingly. There's just a wide range of views as to how this is going to play out. And I think it's really not clear. I think we're going to see a real old-fashioned marketplace showdown here over the next couple of years.
Yeah, I agree. It's going to be interesting. There are a lot of good ideas, but not all of them will gain traction in the market. So we're going to have to see how this plays out. Brad, one of the let's do this. Let me give you a couple of questions, then we'll open it up to questions on the line. But one of the pre-submitted questions was, how does the DOL get jurisdiction over IRAs and IRA rollovers? Can you comment on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. We've been getting that now for quite a while because of the whole fiduciary rule. So the way it works is there are parallel provisions in ERISA and the code for prohibited transactions, and they hinge around the definition of fiduciary. So things self-dealing by a fiduciary, DOL has the authority to interpret the prohibited transaction rules. So when they change the definition of fiduciary, when they put out an exemption, that affects both the plan side and the code side, which is where IRAs and similar tax-preferred vehicles live, so to speak. So DOL doesn't have the authority to cause a IRA owner to behave or an IRA advisor to behave a certain way as a fiduciary, but they can cause their compensation, if they're a fiduciary, to be considered a prohibited transaction. So the exemption that they're proposing, as Fred pointed out, is good for both plans and IRAs because it's saying if you follow these conditions, then the receipt of the compensation that is otherwise a prohibited transaction under the code for the IRA will be okay. So in other words, DOL has the ability to reach in and talk about IRAs, even though they don't have the ability to directly regulate them or enforce them. The IRS retains the enforcement authority while DOL gets the interpretive authority.
Okay, Brad, here's another one for you. What do you think the impact of the DOL's proposed reg on ESG will be on the use of biblically responsible investing in ERISA plans? And you might even expand that a little bit to say other special purpose factors. And what do you think?
Yeah, so, again, as I said before, this isn't a flat-out prohibition. It's saying that you have to consider the economic interests of the plan first and foremost. So when you're looking at investments that utilize ESG, religious, whatever other factors, the question is, are these factors pecuniary? Well, under the new proposal would be, are they pecuniary or non-pecuniary? But even under the existing guidance, the question would be, are you selecting this investment and is it appropriate for the plan? In other words, does it pass your normal screening? You know, if you went through all the factors that investments that are suitable for your plan are supposed to meet, would it come out the other side as a prudent investment, or are you actually sacrificing returns, increasing risk in order to achieve those collateral goals? And so when you're looking at whether it's, biblically responsible or Sharia law or all those questions, the core issue I would say is when you analyze this investment, is it going to pass muster as an investment? And if it's not, then that's where you probably have some concerns. Now, there are some approaches that might reduce those. For example, a common approach is to provide a brokerage window that would then give access to a range of investments that could include ones that would not be, standalone investment appropriate for ERISA. But the issue basically comes down to, is this prudent or not if you apply your normal processes? That's not the way the law, that's not the way the guidance reads, but that's practically how you would approach it.
Yeah, I think so too. If you do your regular screens, your qualitative, your quantitative process, and it produces a number of prudent investments, then that investment is prudent. If you don't pass those screens, then you run a risk that it wouldn't be, and you're better off with that brokerage alternative that that Brad mentioned. Well, operator, why don't we open up some questions on the line?
Thank you. If you'd like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. And if you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on the phone line will indicate when your line is open. At that time, please state your name before posing your question. Again, press star 1 to ask a question, and we'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal for questions.
Let me ask Brad a question while we wait. Brad, I think this refers to the DOL rules. How will those DOL rules we've discussed today or proposals impact non-ERISA 403B plans?
Essentially, they wouldn't. That's, you know, 403B becomes a very confusing place because the term 403B describes at least three different types of plans that are regulated quite differently. So the ERISA-covered 403Bs, so your non-church nonprofits, non-governmentals, would be subject to all of these requirements we've just discussed. Your governmental 403Bs would not be subject to any of these ERISA standards, although I do think it's common to see some of those notions become adopted voluntarily on the governmental side. Things like the 408B2 notices, et cetera, have become common there, but they're not technically required. And unfortunately, Fred, I have to jump off. So
that's fine, Brad. No problem.
I will leave everyone in Fred's capable hands.
There you go. Hey, operator, do we have any questions?
Yes, we'll go to that first question in the queue.
Hello. Hello.
Fred. Hello, Fred. This is Vance Fallbaum out in Tucson. It's my understanding correct that the QCDs expire 12/31, so if I've adopted it for this plan year, I don't have to do anything to make them go away after December 31st?
Yeah, they're just they're a 1 year, and in that sense, they're a temporary rule. If the coronavirus pandemic continues, it's possible Congress could extend it beyond that. But absent further congressional action, yes, it ends at the end of this year.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
And we'll move
operator,
to the next question.
Another?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Next caller, please
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hello. This is Kathy Ireland. I guess I was
Hi,
also
Kathy.
Interested in Brad's input on this, but what are the chances of a hearing, particularly on the exemption, on the fiduciary issue?
Yeah, a number of people are asking for hearings on the fiduciary issue and on the ESG issue. The DOL is allowing very short comment periods, which people are also objecting to, that they need more time to comment. Other folks are urging the department to issue an RFI, for example, on the ESG issues so that they educate themselves before producing a final regulation. Right now, I think the odds of anything I just said is being offered as comments is virtually nil. And Kathy, I could be overly pessimistic, but I know those messages have been communicated to the department, and I haven't seen anything yet or heard anything yet that they're being positively received. So I'm not an optimist. Sorry about that.
Thanks.
Sure.
And as a reminder, you may press star 1 on your telephone keypad if you have a question at this time. That is star 1 for questions. We'll pause another moment.
Let me ask another question that was sent in before the call. Will the PEP effective date get pushed back? I seriously doubt it. It's statutory. Only Congress could push it back. I think they're very much preoccupied with the two bills, the Senate and the House bills that are designed to provide pandemic relief. There's nothing in there that would do that in the current versions of the two bills. So I think that, I don't think it'll be pushed back. Now, having said that, some people are ready to go to market. I mean, they know the model they're going to use. They're building it. It will be up and running on January 1. Other folks are going to wait for the DOL guidance on prohibited transaction exemptions. That, I think they're going to wait, and they may be second to market. In other words, I don't think they're going to be out operating on January 1. So while the deadline itself may not be moved back as a legal matter, as a practical matter, I think these different business models are going to roll out over the course of 2021. It's here. I think it's here, and it will be January 1. Are there other questions, operator?
Yes, we'll go to that next question.
Hi, Fred. Ken Matson in Chicago. I was just curious, you didn't mention anything in the last two of these webinars about guaranteed income reporting to participants per the SECURE Act. Have you heard anything further on that at all?
My understanding is that there are proposals at the I'm thinking of projections of retirement income. Just as an aside, by the way, my understanding is there are proposals at the White House right now, the Office of Management and Budget, on the projection of retirement income. In terms of the SECURE Act guaranteed, that's coming into effect. But no, I haven't heard anything about guidance from the DOL on that. Sorry.
Yeah, I was talking about specifically about the reporting to participants, the annual statements that have been that were part of the SECURE Act.
Oh, the projection. Yeah, the projection of retirement
yes,
income.
Sir.
Yes, there are proposals at the White House, at the Office of Management and Budget. They're reviewing them, and they'll be out. The projections don't become effective until 12 months after there is at the least an interim final regulation. And if you sort of add two and two together in terms of time, I think in the next few months we'll see what the DOL has to say. I think we'll get an interim final before the end of the year, which suggests that in 2022, the projections of retirement income for 401k plans, for example, will be mandated. But I don't think we'll see the actual, unless plan sponsors do it voluntarily, I don't think we'll see them mandated in 2021 to do it. That'll be a 2022 thing.
So sometime in the 12 months of 2022 calendar?
Yeah. I think what, I mean, it only has to be done once a year by a plan. That's the rule. Yeah. And so I think somewhere in the 2022 timeframe, that projection will be made. It makes the most sense from my perspective to make it as of December 31. So unless there's some relief, some people may voluntarily do it in the first quarter of 2022 for December 31, 2021 account balances. But I don't think we'll physically see it in 2021.
So are those proposals public?
No. The Office of OMB has historically been screwed down very tightly in terms of the release of information. So they're not public, and don't expect to hear much about them. But they'll be out in a few months, yeah.
Will there be discussion periods on that after they're released? Or is it final when they're released?
Always. At least 30 days.
Great.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. Operator, any other questions?
And we'll go to that next question in the queue, sir.
This will be the last question. Yeah,
Fred, I just wanted to comment on the ESG and get your feedback on it. I see the what the DOL did was I thought it was positive that they gave feedback and because what I'm seeing out of this and the rest of the consultant is a lot of emotions on the ESG issue, and I think that they kind of caution the plan fiduciaries to take the emotional side of it out, which is nothing new. You know, that's with any investment decisions that are made. I also see it that there should be a disconnect from the enterprise level and what the enterprise may be doing on ESG to the plan itself. There should be separated as far as the decisions, and that, you know, that the activists on maybe on a fiduciary committee need to be somewhat taken into account as far as the, jumping into the ESG. And my real concern is that the taking out good investments out of the investment lineup that may be really good investments that may not meet their criteria for ESG, I see that as a real fiduciary issue. I see the ESG.
Yeah, let me interrupt for just a minute here. We're out of time, so let me just answer the question that you've posed so far. I've had to do a lot of reading to understand what's going on with the ESG rules, and I've read a number of authoritative reports about how ESG factors can and have in fact produced superior returns or less volatility or both. And I think the point is, if it's a pecuniary factor, ESG or any other factor is a pecuniary factor, then it should be considered in the process. As the Harvard comment letter said, in that case, it would be a fiduciary breach to not consider ESG factors. So, but that's a debate that's best left to the investment community. It's really not something the government should dictate. It's something that investment professionals should decide. So, let me raise and answer one last question, and then we've got to run. And thanks everybody for hanging in. The question is, could I clarify the self-employed qualified plan requirement and regulation best interest? And the Reg BI says that an ERISA governed retirement plan, for example, any retirement plan, is not a retail customer. And the significance of that is that Reg BI only applies to retail customers. So, but there's a footnote in the adoption or the adopting release for Reg BI that says, well, the FCC says, well, if it's a sole proprietor, maybe with just a couple of employees, then that would be effectively advice to the sole proprietor, and that would be advice to a retail customer. So it creates a mess. So how would an investment advisor or a broker-dealer know they had to deliver their form CRS because of a footnote? To illustrate how difficult that rule is, if that same person, that same sole proprietor, incorporated, same person, same two employees, then it would no longer be a retail customer. And no longer would Reg BI apply, no longer would a form CRS have to be provided. So it's a little gotcha that if you're a broker-dealer, a gotcha that's in the regulation. Also, if you're an investment advisor delivering your form CRS. So but just remember, sole proprietor plan, it is really a self-employed person. It's not a small corporation or a small LLC. Anyway, guys, thanks for hanging in so long. We really appreciate your time. I just want to, in closing, point out that our next session is scheduled for October 29th, so if you could put that on your calendar, it would be great. I also want to thank Brad, who, as you know, had to run, did a great job summarizing this stuff for you all. And I want to thank Jim Dolan and Matt Texas for bringing this to you. So, folks, we'll talk again on October 29th. Thanks. Bye-bye.